So Hebrews 1, verse 5 to 14. And I will start from verse 1. In the past, God spoke to our forefathers through the prophets at many times and in various ways. But in these last days, he has spoken to us by his Son, whom he appointed heir of all things and through whom he made the universe. The Son is the radiance of God's glory and the exact representation of his being, sustaining all things by his powerful word. After he had provided purification for sins, he sat down at the right hand of the majesty in heaven. So he became as much superior to the angels as the name he has inherited is superior to theirs. For to which of the angels did God ever say, "You are my son, today I have become your father"? Or again, "I will be his father and he will be my son"? And again, when God brings his firstborn into the world, he says, "Let all God's angels worship him." In speaking of the angels, he says, "He makes his angels winds, his servants flames of fire." But about the Son, he says, "Your throne, O God, will last forever and ever, and righteousness will be the scepter of your kingdom. You have loved righteousness and hated wickedness. Therefore God, your God, has set you above your companions by anointing you with the oil of joy." He also says, "In the beginning, O Lord, you laid the foundations of the earth, and the heavens are the work of your hands. They will perish, but you remain. They will all wear out like a garment. You will roll them up like a rope. Like a garment they will be changed, but you remain the same, and your years will never end." To which of the angels did God ever say, "Sit at my right hand until I make your enemies a footstool for my feet"? Are not all angels ministering spirits sent to serve those who will inherit salvation? May the Lord bless the reading of his word.
Well, last week although Hugo read from verse 1, we're not going to look at from verse 1, there was quite a lot to look at last week. So last week we looked at verses 1 to 5 and we had an introduction to the book of Hebrews, and that's online. And we saw that the book is addressing the problem of drift, and there are different kinds of ways Christians can drift. Now, the most obvious way is to just totally give up, just turn away from the faith. Now, that's not really drift, that's giving up. But there's other ways we can more subtly drift. So we could stop gathering. So you could say, "I'm a Christian, but I don't go to church." Or you could slip into an Old Testament style of religion. And we'll think about that in a moment, what I mean by that. And then there's various other kinds of drift that Hebrews doesn't address specifically, but we find that the stuff we get here helps us for those kinds of drift as well. As if God knew what he was doing when he inspired it. And the problem with drift is that it is drift. That's what it is. You see, if there's a big heresy, so if I stood up here in front of you and said, "You know the Trinity, well, there's four," or something like that, you just see it coming and you go, "Well, that's ridiculous. That's just so obvious." Well, to you it is. It's not to everybody. Well, there's some big morality issue. You would suddenly sit up and go, "Well, I better pay attention to that. That doesn't sound quite right." It's that problem of the boiling a frog. Have you heard this one? I don't know who boils frogs for fun. But you know the thing is, if you drop a frog into boiling hot water, please see me afterwards. But if you do drop a frog into boiling hot water, it leaps out again. If you put it in a pan in cold water and bring it to the boil, the frog just goes, "Oh, it's quite nice, quite relaxing," until it's boiled alive. So I'm told. And so that's the problem with Christians, is we drift slowly. And so that's why we need Hebrews. After a while, we end up miles from where we started. And the solution to that comes in Hebrews. And sometimes he takes us to the issues of drifting and says, "Don't do that." But more often than not, the main way, we saw this last week, the main way the writer stops us from drifting is to go, look, Jesus is amazing. Wow, look at who he is. Look at what he's done. That's it. Why would you drift from, how could you drift from there? That's his main ways. The reason why you're drifting is you've moved away from Jesus. You've not seen who he is, what he's done, and you've just become a bit lukewarm about it. And so he wants us informed, not just informed though, but amazed and awed at who Jesus is. What is the opposite to drift? It's not a joke. What is the opposite to drift? Is worship, and more about that later. Now, last week we saw that Jesus is God's final word, and we've sung about that already this evening. He is God's absolute revelation. God's revealed himself in a number of ways, but it is in an absolute and final way in Jesus Christ. And Jesus is the supreme. Wow, we look at him, we read of him, and we go, wow, that's incredible. And next week, we get the application of all that. It's Alistair, I think, next week, and chapter 2, verse 1. We must pay more careful attention, therefore, to what we have heard, so that we do not drift away. Now, this week's focus is some more about Jesus, before we get to that, and about what we ended with last time, is that Jesus is over and above the angels. Now, at first glance, you might go, okay, well, I thought he was over and above the angels anyway, but all right then. And we thought a bit about that last week. So just as a recap, in the Old Testament, God reveals himself, and not just himself, but how you worship him. But God is always mediated in the Old Testament. You need someone to, you can't just walk into God's presence. You need someone to get you there. So that's through a priest, through Moses in a big way, and through angels. Angels are God's messengers. In fact, it says that, doesn't it, in verse 14? They are ministering spirits. They are winds and flames. And so in the time of Hebrews, there were various distortions of those ideas as well. And so what we see as we go through the book of Hebrews is that Old Testament religion is not wrong. It was God's idea. I think we sometimes forget that. The Old Testament religion is not wrong, but it in and of itself points to something greater. So what makes sense is to go where it's pointing. You know, you see a signpost, you don't walk up to a signpost and go, there I am. You've got to go to where it's pointing. So what the writer to Hebrews, when we get to that point, it will say, don't go back into ritual and ceremony and things, the concrete things, nor go off into sort of super spiritual things, seemingly so. And we're tempted in both directions, because what we're doing here tonight can, if we don't understand what we're doing, can look a bit boring. And so we want to spice it up until we realize what it is that we're doing. And so the way to show Christ is greater, even greater than the angels, so these mighty spiritual beings, is through some highlights of the Psalms. So far from, if you just took a couple of verses in isolation, you would think the writer of the Hebrews is saying, forget about the Old Testament a long time ago. He makes his case from the Old Testament. So we've got this string of highlights from the Psalms. So far from the Old Testament being irrelevant, it needs to be understood through Christ, but also we need it to show us Christ more fully, in full colour, if you like. So that's what the writer does here. So he had to point the first readers and later Old Testament readers, and from that to us. So the Psalms had a point then, and to Old Testament readers, those points still stand, but also these Psalms have a deeper or fuller point when we see them through Christ. And so we're going to have a bit of there's a lot that could be said here, but just to get a taster now with that point to stop us from drifting. And the Psalms, all the Psalms, show us the greatness of Christ. And where I'm saying this, 2 weeks before we take an associate minister who has a PhD in the Psalms, so ask him about it when he comes. But the Psalms are showing us the greatness of Christ. And this is where we're going tonight. We see that Jesus, this is what the Psalms teach, Jesus is the glorious God, that he is the joyful husband, and that he is the conquering king. And from that, as we'll pick up next week, don't drift. Listen and don't drift. So the first thing is that Jesus is glorious God. Jesus is the glorious God. And we see this in the first quotes, but we see it actually sprinkled through these quotes. There's a contrast between these mighty spiritual beings, the angels, their wind and their flame, they're powerful. You know, you see it in stained glass windows and children's nativity things. I remember Josiah being in one and the girls with their white tights and the angel wings, and it's all very cute. Not in the Bible, they're not cute in the slightest. These powerful, mighty warriors. And he compares those with Jesus and shows the big difference is that he is God. So the first two contrasts come from Psalm 2 and then the context of Psalm 2, which is 2 Samuel 7. So he quotes from those two places. And the angels, he shows us, are not God's son. Which angel did he ever say, you're my son to? Now in Psalm 2 and 2 Samuel 7, these are addressed to David, Israel's great king, who rules for God. Now we'll come back to that in a moment. And we see in Psalm 2 that it really bigs up David in a huge way. But of Jesus, it fits perfectly because, as Psalm 2 says, he shares God's rule as eternal king. But a bit more, sneaking into verse 8, notice he says, about the Son, he says, and then quotes the Psalm, your throne, O God. About the Son, he says, your throne, O God. So there are two distinct persons in this psalm called the one God. So God the Father and God the Son. And in verse 10, he says, the one who made the earth, notice, O Lord. Jesus is the one who made the earth and is called O Lord. And there's a quote there from Psalm 110. And Psalm 110, the praise is addressed to God. If you still need convincing, verse 6. And again, when God brings his firstborn into the world, he says, let all God's angels worship him. If you chat to a JW, there's quite a lot in Chelmsford, and they claim that Jesus is the archangel Michael, and that he's just an angel. I mean, if you can say just before the word angel. But look at verse 6. It says, which angel, which one of the angels did God say of? And obviously the answer to that is not Michael. The answer is there are no angels that God said that are to be worshipped. They are to worship him. And there's a reference there. This is a quote from Deuteronomy. There's a reference to God who is to be worshipped. And it's applied there to Jesus. So no angel says, worship me. They say, don't worship me, worship him. That's angels' jobs. Help us to worship him. Now, an aside about JWs, they will make something else in these verses as well. Is verse 9, it says, God, your God. And so there are two gods, a kind of a big one and a little one. No, one God in two persons. Well, actually in three persons, but only two of them are mentioned here. So very simple application here, I've already said it, which is worship. As Hebrew goes on, we'll see that there's a lot to say about worship. Someone said that Hebrews is a theology of worship. And there are different chunks as we go through. We'll make a different emphasis. So one emphasis is going to be worship as all of life. So we don't worship at church and then at work or study. That's something totally separate where we do anything but worship. But then also when we get to it, it will have about worship together. So we are to draw close to God together, and something, if you like, vertical happens. There's something that we offer to God and something he does to us, and God is building a worshiping community that starts here and goes on into eternity. And one of the points Hebrews will make is that when we do this, and sometimes it looks a bit disappointing, you're actually doing something that is mind-blowing. But also there's a, if you like, a horizontal dimension as well, that we have a responsibility and a function to each other. So it's not just a simultaneous quiet time that we do here. It's not something we could do online, but together we're to encourage each other, spur each other, egg each other on. And that's important because there are different schools of thought about worship. And I'll put my hand up here and say, at some point or another, I've been all of these. So one of them is worship is singing. So you may go to a church and say, we're now going to have a time of worship, meaning now we're going to have a time of singing. It's okay to have a time of singing, but it's not distinct from worship. It's not that the sermon and the prayers were completely anything but worship, or that liturgy is worship. You know, we do the responses and say things together. And others will say that, well, we worship God with all our life. We worship all the time. Or except for when we gather together. That's encouragement. Now, those have all got a bit of truth in them, but we've got to put them together. And that's what Hebrews does. It all comes together in a more very full-bodied way. And more about that in future weeks. But for now, a few thoughts about drift versus worship. When you come to church, it may be you come to church and you like that, that's nice. And then you go to work or to school or to university, whatever it is you do, and you think that is totally unrelated. But we've seen, just in these verses in Hebrews so far, who Jesus is. He is very God. He's the creator of all things. And I'll save you the Abraham Kuyper quote. You all know that now. But he is the king of the universe. He rules all things. All things are ruled by Jesus. And that must affect how we live at work or how we study, how we view our work and study. Your work, you can say, is holy work, whatever it is that you do, unless it's illegal. And it's part of a bigger picture. So if you're a student at Rittle and you're studying something to do with plants or animals or whatever, well, who created them? Who sustains them? The Lord Jesus did. That affects how you study and view these things, doesn't it? That we can worship him in our work, by the way we approach our work. If you're a doctor, if you're a teacher, you look at your work. Even architects can look at their work in a different way because of Jesus is Lord of their work. Another way worship counters drift is just to acknowledge God at home. You get up in the morning, as you brush your teeth, as you get ready for work, in the car or on the train, is just to pray, to read the Bible by yourself, in your family. Now that's very important for, and I can't think of the right word, so I'll just say churches like ours, because from what you tell me, unless you just feel that I need to be made to feel better, is you all like a sermon. And you're very positive about it, especially if I shout at you and tell you you're sinners. You seem to love that. So you tell me that you like that. You like reading the Bible, most of you, it seems. You talk about that. And quite a lot of you like reading Christian books, and some of them quite meaty ones. So you love it when someone says, see this connection here, see this bit here, isn't that bit like the psalm? You love all that, and you get very excited about it. And so we get into very clever bits of the Bible, and then we miss who it is that it's about, and fail to worship him. And that is a form of drift. That's a very sound form of drift, but it's a form of drift. We need to step back in awe and worship. Now, that's all good stuff, by the way, to read Christian books and to do all that and see the connections. And what it should do is it should foster worship in us all the time. But I know I can do this, is that because I'm a professional, I can get into the detail and miss the star of the show. Because I've gone, oh, that's interesting, because the Hebrew word for... And off I go. And I haven't actually sat back in awe in worship of the Lord Jesus, who's there in the page in front of me. And then, of course, the most obvious way, and Hebrews will talk about this later, is about not neglecting gathering the church. Value it. Why wouldn't you do these things? In fact, it's interesting, it'll come up in a few weeks, not just Sundays, but he says every day. We don't make that demand of you, but gathering as Christians, formally, informally, do not neglect it. Value it. Why wouldn't you want to worship this Jesus with other Christians? Jesus is the glorious God. What application can that have? Worship. That will stop you drifting. Jesus is the glorious God. The second thing is, and that's me being behind with my slides again. Jesus is the joyful husband. In verses 8 to 9. Now that seems a strange heading from the reading. Now there's a modern problem with reading the Bible, especially when the New Testament quotes the Old Testament. And that is we assume that here we are in 2015, that we have a far better idea than those who were reading it in the first century. You know, the ones who had Hebrew for a first language and stuff like that. We're bound to know more, aren't we? And of what the Old Testament writers meant. So we get to Hebrews 1 and we think this is a string of proof texts, and then we look them up and we scratch our heads. In fact, we can't really work out why he used them and how they help our understanding in the New Testament at all. Why he didn't just skip to chapter 2? And we assume that New Testament writers are a bit dim, and we don't consider for a moment the problem might be us. I'm slightly biased there because of the sort of books that ministers end up reading, but that's the kind of thing I get in some of the books, that, you know, what on earth is the writer doing here? In fact, the writers are very, very careful in their use. New Testament writers are extremely diligent in their use of the Old Testament. But the way it works is that the quotes are kind of a tip of an iceberg principle. So when they quote one verse from Psalm 2 or whatever it might be, in this case Psalm 45, they intend you to be so familiar you know the context of that psalm and the rest of the psalm. But the bits that they are quoting are sort of key points, but they think you know the rest of it. They didn't know that 2015 was going to happen, obviously. So look at verses 8 to 9. Now, it enforces the point that I've just made. Jesus is God. It also enforces our next point when we get to it, that it talks about his scepter and his kingly rule. So apart from this build-up effect, which the writer of the Hebrews likes, you wonder, why does he need this quote too? Papyrus was pretty expensive. Why does he take it up? Well, if you turn back with me, I'm putting my order of service into Hebrews, and turn back to Psalm 45, it will help us. We could have done this with all of the psalms he quotes, but we'd be here for a long time. But if you look up Psalm 45, it's on page 569. Now, the first thing you do when you read a psalm by yourself is look at the headings. Now, the font doesn't help in the NIV because the NIV puts these sort of slightly smaller font italic sometimes to help us break up the text. And it does that in the psalms. But in the psalms, those are not what the editors have put in. That's what the writers have put in. That's in the original scripture. And in the Hebrews, Hebrew, that's always verse 1. So the first thing to do is to read the heading. So the heading says, "For the director of music, to the tune of lilies, of the sons of Korah, a maskil, a wedding song." So this is a wedding song. That helps, doesn't it? This is a wedding song. And we read, as we read through it, we see the occasion is the wedding of the king in verse 1. It's one of David's descendants, and he's getting married, and this is written to be sung at his service. Now, unlike our weddings, which are all about the bride, this focuses on the groom first. The Pavies aren't here for me to tease, but Rob and Laura got married the other week, and the focus was all on Laura. All the speeches that kept on coming up, Laura, Laura, Laura. Oh, this bloke Rob as well has turned up. But it's all about the bride. Even the royal wedding, the future king, they were talking about Kate's dress. That's our culture. But look at this psalm. Verse 2, "You are the most excellent of men, and your lips have been anointed with grace, since God has blessed you forever." So the point that keeps on coming up in this psalm is that what a very handsome, brave, and wise and blessed king that you have that's about to get married. That's the first half of the psalm. But then verse 9, there's a transition. "Daughters of kings are among your honoured women. At your right hand is the royal bride in gold of Ophir." And then verses 10 to 17 focuses on the bride. And I'll give you a sample of what she's like. So verses 10 and 11, "Listen, O daughter, consider and give ear. Forget your people and your father's house." So she's moving from her house to her husband's house. "The king is enthralled by your beauty. Honor him, for he is your lord." Verses 13 and start 14, "All glorious is the princess within her chamber. Her gown is interwoven with gold. In embroidered garments she is led to the king." Now notice how people bring her gifts. They seek her favour. They want to be on the right side of her. And the virgin bride is led to her king. That's a great psalm, fitting for the marriage of a king. But which king? Well, the king of God's people, a descendant of David. But we keep seeing how the Psalms are being used in the New Testament, either as prayed by Jesus or in some way describing his role. So not only is the writer in Hebrews showing us that Jesus is God and that Jesus is king, but related to that, Jesus is the groom. It's about the nature of the relationship his people are to have with him. Now, we've talked about this a lot, especially back when we did Ephesians and some other things, is there are three images about how we relate to Christ. Head and body, he's the head, with the body. The vine and branches, he's the plant with the branches of that. And husband and wife. And they express different aspects of how we join with to Christ. So in the Old Testament, God is the groom who is engaged to his bride, Israel. In the New Testament, the engagement is over and he is now married. Christ is the husband and the church is the wife. And the emphasis again is Jesus is glorious God and King. Now, why do we need to know this? Remember, the problem is drift. Now, at times, because we sin and then we feel guilt, maybe we have low self-esteem, whatever it is, we just feel unworthy of God. Well, that is a half-truth. You are unworthy of God, but you are saved. You're made righteous. You're clothed in his righteousness. You are joined like a head and body, or a branch and vine, or a husband and wife. He is committed to you. Marriage is an illustration of this. He's committed to you by a covenant. More of that later as we go through Hebrews. So you are married to him. Now, that's not just good news, because marriage is a strong commitment. But it's not just that it's God's duty to put up with you. But look at Psalm 45, of what your husband thinks of you. He thinks that you're beautiful and clothed in gold. Now, I asked this when we looked at Galatians. How does God feel about you tonight after last week? You know, you aim to have at least 5 quiet times through the week. You know, we know 7 is impossible. So 5 quiet times this week, you've had 1, and that wasn't that good. You shouted at the kids, and it wasn't really their fault. You swore at your boss. You had some nasty thoughts that you would really not want to share with anyone at church. And really, you've only come tonight because you had a job to do. Like give the sermon. How does God feel about you after a week like that? He is delighted in you. He is delighted in you. You make his heart skip a beat, if you could use those terms of God. It's like, for those of us who have ever been a groom, or might hope to be, is you look down the aisle and the girl you've been engaged to, and you got engaged to her because you thought she was a pretty good deal to start with. So you look down the and you think, how did she top it? She looks amazing. That's how God feels about you, says Psalm 45. How can you drift from your husband, Lord, knowing he feels about you that way? Jesus rejoices in you, Luke 15. He is always pleased to see you. Have you got a friend like that who's always pleased to see you? Usually pleased to see you, that's what makes a friend, but always pleased to see you. He is your joyful husband. And the third thing we get in this string of Psalms is that Jesus is the conquering king in verses 10 to 14. Now, I mentioned, this has come up in the previous 2 points, that Jesus is a king. That's kind of obvious. If he's God, God is the king. Old Testament, God is the groom, Jesus is the husband. But what kind of king is he? And once we get an answer, we'll see how it helps against drift. Now, the plan in the Old Testament is that God will have a man rule the world as king. That was Adam. And he ruled the world. There were only a couple of people in it at the time. That's God's job for him. Dominion over the world. So over all the animals and the plants. And Adam failed. And not only did Adam fail, but part of the judgment, God's judgment on him, is frustration. Adam's rule is frustrated. You know, the stuff to do with weeds and things like that. So his rule is frustrated. What he tries to do fails. All human leadership from that day onwards is like that. It's frustrated and ultimately fails. It's the story of empires, isn't it? They get big and then they fail. And then God calls Abraham, and through his descendants, the world is going to be blessed. And Israel is meant to be a nation that draws the nations together, ruled by God's king. But as you know, that fails. And as you know as well, Jesus fulfills all those Old Testament shadows. He reigns, although we can't see it now, and one day he will reign fully and everyone will see it. And the Old Testament anticipates his rule. Psalm 2 and Psalm 45 we've already seen, and now Psalm 102. What kind of king is he? He is the conquering king. Now, there's been lots about democracy and politics in media and social media in the last few weeks and last couple of years. And, you know, Corbyn's been the latest thing. And now Trump, we won't talk about Trump, if any of you have got an American connection. But Corbyn has been really interesting because some think he's brilliant and some think that the party has chosen very badly. But the way the system works means they chose. And that's what they've got. And some people don't like our government. But we chose them, and that's what we've got. And the reason why, right back at the Reformation, right the way through to now, the reason why Reformed Christians like democracy so much is not because people are really good at picking leaders. History tells us that we're not. But to sack corrupt ones and limit the evil and tyranny of governments. Their job is to convince us that they might do a good job. Our job is to sack them. We can't pick good ones. However, the same is not true of Jesus. We've seen already that Jesus is the glorious God and the joyful husband. He is all-powerful and full of love and compassion. If he were just either one of those, he'd be either terrifying or useless. Now, do you see the nature of his kingship here? It's not like voting for someone. So verse 5, we get Psalm 2. We sometimes sing Psalm 2 at church. I think we're singing it next week. I've somehow managed to get all our songs and psalms that fit really well with Hebrews a week out of sync, but some of it still works anyway. But Psalm 2, the nations confront God's Christ, and Christ wins. And all people, including rulers, face a choice, kiss the Son, make peace with him, or be smashed to pieces. Verse 8 talks about an eternal throne. And then verses 11 to 14, I'll read them to you. It's a quote from Psalm 102. So verse 10, he also says, "In the beginning, O Lord, you laid the foundations of the earth, and the heavens and the work of your hands. They will perish, but you will remain. They will all wear out like a garment. You will roll them up like a robe. Like a garment they will be changed, but you remain the same, and your years will never end." To which of the angels did God ever say, "Sit at my right hand until I make your enemies a footstool for your feet"? Now notice the contrast at the end with the angels again. Angels are the ground troops. The Son is the leader. He's the victor. He is the conquering king. All opposition melts before him. So not only is this is not a democracy, this is not vote for Jesus, it's not even a fair fight. Ultimately, that will be seen. But even before then, as his church continues to take ground. We've been encouraged by a bit of growth each year here at CPC, but globally the church is growing at extraordinary rates. We looked at the book of Acts a year or two ago, and it starts with a handful of Christians, only just into double figures. And I googled how many Christians are in the world, and of 6.9 billion people in the world, 2.18 billion call themselves Christian. Now, there's caveats about what do they mean by that, but the fact that that number identifying as Christian is staggering. They started with 11 confused blokes and a few women in Jerusalem to 2.18 billion. Jesus is conquering people's hearts. And when he returns, all opposition to him will fail. Now, how does that keep us from drift? I think I can think of three ways, but there might be more. And these are all kind of related. So I'm thinking of the nervous Christians, the frustrated Christians, and the desperate Christians. And they're kind of similar. So the nervous Christians need to know this. Who is king? Jesus is king. And we apologize for being Christians. We feel that we're stepping on...